This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Whether saving and investing for a house, college, or retirement, you need to know how to best make your money work for you. Madeline Matlock, Senior Portfolio Manager with Pioneer Investments, a global investment manager, and investment advisor Krista Simeo will discuss how to take control of your finances with a look at the emerging markets. And you can join this conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Exactly. And we'll talk about even the developed markets, too. And Madeline, it's so good to see you here live again and in person.
Yes, it's great to be here.
How was the drive-in from amongst your fellow Delhesians?
Very sloppy.
Very sloppy? I see. But they got the roads okay.
So far, so good.
Good. Good. You know, there's an old I'm seeing the devastation in some of the emerging markets that's been visited upon these things so far this year. I'm reminded of the old story about the Vikings who, you know, get a little carried away and they just, you know, they're being way too destructive. And the head of the Vikings said something like, gentlemen, remember, it's pillage first, then burn. There's been this indiscriminate selling in the emerging markets. I mean, are there pockets of A, emerging markets, and B, just foreign markets in general that might not be emerging but are developing that look like bargains now?
Well, first of all, I think you have to separate markets from each other. You can't talk about emerging markets all as one block.
And people do, unfortunately.
It is not a single decision. There are a vast range of economies and political risk sets and opportunity sets in emerging markets, and you really have to differentiate. And also, in the developing markets, the same thing. For instance, last year, a market that had been left for dead for many years posted in local currency terms over a 50% return, and that would be Japan. So things do change over time depending on what's going on the ground.
I think the one thing that's always confused me, Madeline, is what is an emerging market? How is that defined?
Well, it's getting it much more difficult to define the difference. For instance, last year there was a big disagreement over whether South Korea is an emerging market or not, and one index took it in as a developed country and another index did not. Right now there are kind of three different levels. There's the developed emerging markets.
Which would be countries such as?
Such as Taiwan, South Korea, China, where there's enough opportunity, enough liquidity, enough history that you can say, I kind of know what's going to happen here, and I can get down to the company level much more easily. Then there, at the other end, are the frontier markets.
The so-called frontier markets.
Yes.
The Wild West.
The Wild West. And I think some people may forget sometimes that it is the Wild West. We're talking about markets in the Middle East or Northern Africa, where everything is just a little bit different and a lot less liquid.
You know, among the plethora of fine programming available here on WVXU and WMUB is the BBC World News Overnight, which has ruined the sleep of any otherwise sane person. Because once you start listening, you just can't turn it off. But a few weeks ago, they had the gentleman from Goldman Sachs who coined the phrase BRICS to stand for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And now he's big on the so-called mint countries, Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Turkey. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about these things. What are your thoughts as someone who's been managing international investing for so long about the shift away from BRICS to mints?
Well, stay away from the acronyms is the first rule,
okay,
because that will get you in trouble. The BRICS were very different propositions and not really a block. The mints are the same thing. I think things that you have to look for when you're looking for an opportunity in emerging market is what's going on politically and in terms of the economic development of the country. For instance, right now there's a phrase going around called the Fragile Five, and these are countries that are running large current account deficits.
It's not a basketball team.
No. And they are very vulnerable to a slowdown in the flow of liquidity coming into the markets.
And more vulnerable, perhaps, to the Fed's tightening moves.
Although I think you can't – everybody wants to blame the Fed for this.
Been doing it for years.
They've been doing it for years. It's not the Fed's fault. It's the fact that these countries probably had a private sector that got ahead of the public sector in terms of developing taxation and infrastructure processes that could support the kind of growth that they wanted to have.
Great point. We've got a caller here.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's talk to Tom from Oxford. Good afternoon, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
How's the weather up there?
It's not as bad as it is in Cincinnati. We've got about 3 or 4 inches.
Well, that's good to hear. And what question did you have?
Well, as I hear people talk about certain types of stocks or certain types of markets, I get the impression that you're kind of giving advice like maybe you should go chase this, maybe you should consider buying this. So I feel like you're talking about chasing performance, which is not a good idea. I have developed a computer model that shows that if you were to buy the Dow Jones average and nothing else but that, you would outperform most diversified portfolios over a number of years. And by doing that, you could just ignore all this noise about what's really going to do well or what's doing well now. What should I buy?
So are you a buy and hold guy? Are you a buy and hold guy? Is that what you're advocating?
Oh, Lord, yes. Yeah.
Okay, Tom. Yeah. Well, let's let Madeline and
performance buy one stock, the Dow Jones average only.
Let's let Madeline and Chris discuss that. And thank you, Tom. We appreciate the question and the comment.
Thanks for calling, Tom. Madeline.
The process of diversification is really not necessarily to produce returns, but to reduce your volatility risk. So the idea is that you spread your investments over a number of different economies and sets of circumstances so that when something bad happens, it doesn't happen to everything you have all at once. Now, I don't argue that if you take a focused approach and you're very consistent in your investment, you probably do better than someone that's trying to chase the performance that was the best last year.
Which is always
a bad idea.
That
is always a bad idea.
Not just sometimes. Chasing performance is always a bad idea.
If you're going to chase anything, chase non-performance. You'll do better. So it kind of depends on your time horizon and how patient you are and your own psychological makeup. Are you willing to buy when something is down, or do you have to have a lot of confirmation for your ideas before you can go ahead?
Yeah. Why do I feel like Johnny Carson doing the great Karnak thing? I have here in my hands. I'm holding, not holding it up to my forehead, but if you remember just a year ago, back in January, people were worried about the what was happening with the fiscal cliff. And then we got past that. Then people were worried about the sequester. We got past that. Then it was, oh my gosh, Cyprus is blowing up. Now, if remember, one of the big themes from last year was the debt levels and interest rates that seem to be going sky high in the sunny countries, in the southern European countries, Italy, Portugal, Spain. Looking at these numbers here, this is just from today's Bloomberg, but the Italian sovereign bond index, 2.75% yield. Spain, 2.57. Portugal, 3.76. These don't sound like they're falling off a cliff. Even Greece, the yield on Greek bonds has gone from the 30s down to about 8.3. What happened? And why haven't people been talking about that?
It's kind of curious, isn't it? But all the problems that seem to beset the periphery of Europe last year, they have not been solved, but they've certainly been mitigated to a great extent by the fact that they can refinance debt at a much lower level now because the European Central Bank head came out and said, we will do whatever it takes to keep the European Union, the monetary union, together, and we will not let these countries go bankrupt.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that all of Europe is a basket case and that there are developed markets there in Europe and along with some of these, I guess, would you call Spain and Portugal emerging or developed? Or
they're developed countries.
Okay, they're developed. So opportunities then for an investor, would they try to pick individual securities or look for an exchange-traded fund or a broadly diversified open-end fund? What are the best ways for people to diversify their portfolios internationally?
I really think, and I'm speaking from where I am, the best way to diversify internationally, if you are not equipped to invest in individual companies by yourself, which most people are not, is to buy a well-diversified, actively managed international or global fund. Because then you have an army of people who are looking at individual companies. They are looking at the political and economic environment in which you are investing, and they are combining these things together in a whole portfolio that's designed to do at least as well, if not better, than the index itself.
This is like any other investment, though, be it U.S. or international. You have to do your homework about where you're putting your money.
Exactly. This is not blind stuff. You can't do this on automatic, and it's not necessarily statistical. There's two parts to a good investment. The first is the opportunity itself. The second is the price you pay for it. And you have to be conversant with both of those things to succeed.
It's an awfully big dartboard just to cover your eyes and start throwing stuff at it. Should we go to the phones? No? All right.
Nope. Pete's still working on that, so
get
that just a minute more here.
All right.
What are some of the unique risks, Madeline, of emerging market investments? You started to touch on some of them earlier. There's different politics, different government structures, that kind of thing. So you really do have to be pretty savvy and paying attention, or have somebody, like you said, invest in a fund that's doing it for you.
Right, right. I mean, you can see some of the things that have happened just in the last few months, riots in Bangkok and Thailand, or the uproar in Ukraine over whether the country will adhere more to Russian policy or European policy.
Egypt is still
Or Turkey,
simmering,
which is a very developed country that's doing very well but having some political issues. You can't ignore those risks when you're investing in individual stocks in these countries. You have to be aware of those issues and how they'll affect your investment.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about China and whether China's slowing down and whether they're going to have – we thought we'd gotten past that, and suddenly this is the big boulder that's been dropped into the pond, and the ripples have been influencing share prices all around the globe. How much of it really, Madeline, from your perspective as having managed international investments for many years, how much of that really is, you know, something fundamentally wrong with what's going on in China, or is this the market making another mountain out of a molehill?
I think that it's a molehill that we need to pay attention to, but it's a molehill you could expect. China is a huge economy. It's becoming more and more modern every year and getting more and more developed and having more and more influence on overall global growth. So we need to understand what's going on there. But some of the problems that the Chinese government is dealing with in their economy are things that you would expect to happen in that process of maturation. This is not something that's totally unexpected.
Yeah, shifting from an export economy to one that's stimulating domestic demand.
Exactly. I mean, they're trying to create a middle class. They're trying to bring millions and millions of rural folks who lived in almost huts herding pigs into people who are part of a globally focused industrial complex. That's a big chore.
You just described Cincinnati 200 years ago. Seriously. Isn't
yes,
it a great
did.
Book?
Yeah.
Let's go to the phone.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join our conversation. And let's talk with Patrick from Springboro. And Patrick, are you buried in snow up there?
Actually, the roads are pretty clear here, driving out of Lebanon. My question is about emerging markets. I think it's one of the best growth opportunities for the next 10 years, but lately they've kind of taken a turn for the worse. Do you think the emerging markets have sort of hit rock bottom and now's a good time to buy, or do you think they're going to go further south?
I would not be so crazy as to try to call emerging markets up or down. I think one thing that's pretty evident is that the emerging markets as a emblem of growth in the global economy have been a little dented recently. And a part of the problem is that it was kind of a one-decision thing. If you were looking for growth, that's where you went. You bought emerging market stocks. And part of that was because some of these markets kind of sailed through the global financial crisis without too many problems. So they became kind of a safe haven. But there are risks in these markets, and we're seeing them. There's risks of inflation that you're not seeing in developed markets. There are risks of overinvestment in certain areas, and you have to be careful of that. So I wouldn't try to call a bottom in emerging markets. I don't think the prices on stocks, individual stocks, indicate that there's a bottom. But there are certainly individual opportunities that could be interesting in these markets.
So to the average investor like myself, it sounds like a scary world out there. And what is the compelling reason for investing in emerging markets?
Well, the rationale has always been that these countries will grow faster than countries like the U.S. or European countries because their populations are bigger. They're starting from a lower GDP per capita.
Populations are younger, too,
right,
in many
cases.
And
there are new opportunities to create new industries that don't exist locally but exist in other parts of the world. And all of that is still there. But as I said earlier, it all depends on the price you pay for it. Growth is not in and of itself, especially not GDP growth, a ticket towards equity outperformance. Yeah.
Speaking of prices, what are the typical P.E. ratios? How much, in the U.S., for example, the amount of dollars you pay to get a dollar of earnings has been around, 15, 16 on the average, and that number is still kind of in that range. Where do developed foreign markets generally, such as Europe, how does that number compare? And what kind of price tag do you pay for a typical, or is there a price tag you pay for a typical emerging market company?
There's no typical price tag. I think on average, the U.S. in the developed market universe is relatively more expensive than if you took Europe as a whole or Japan as a whole. Emerging markets are so different from each other, it's really hard to say emerging markets are more expensive or less expensive. It depends on how you measure it, but I would say they're at least as expensive.
Yeah, and it was funny to me. You mentioned some of the issues, Madeline, that go with investing in these emerging markets, and liquidity is one of them. When you go to a hotel for the first time, one of the first things you're always taught is, well, see where the exit sign is. When Mr. O'Brien started talking about the mint countries, I had no problem at all finding an exchange-traded fund, for example, that focused strictly on Mexico. No problem at all finding an Indonesia fund. No problem at all finding a Turkey fund. But Nigeria, now that was a different story. I found one, and the market cap of this whole thing was $7 million.
Yeah, and many of these emerging market indexes, if you look at them, are heavily weighted towards banks, telecom companies, utilities, maybe a big miner. Yeah, a lot of these countries are in the commodities business. So you don't have a very diversified economic spread in the indexes either.
So your point is, Chris, if I buy this, I better make sure there's somebody who'd be willing to buy it
from me you.
If I want to get out of it.
Right, 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 because that can liquidity, when liquidity dries up, it's never pretty.
Never pretty. And and I remember back in the Asian crisis when Thailand and Malaysia and Indonesia and all those
South
countries
Korea, yeah, the Asian
had
tigers.
Problems, and Malaysia just said, no, we're not giving you your money back. We don't have it. We're not giving it back to you. And you have to wait over a year to get your money back out.
And now you've got this other dynamic where a lot of these countries now have their so-called sovereign wealth funds. Norway has a huge one. And these funds get so big from all their energy money, all their oil money, they don't know what to do with it. Are these things causing disruptions? Are some of the volatility, Madeline, that we're seeing in foreign markets in general and emerging markets in particular the result of big pools of money trying to find a way to build a position in an otherwise illiquid market?
I think there's no doubt that there are some very large investors who are looking for these opportunities and can put more money to work in these ideas than really is productive. They know that, so they aren't going to put that money to work unless they have a much longer time horizon. But at the margin, things do seem to swing around more than they used to. There are global macro funds that try to move from one spot to another and grab opportunities, but they don't have a time horizon of more than 2 or 3 months.
These big hedge funds.
Yes. Yes.
Madeline, do the emerging markets follow that same basic risk-reward rule that the higher-risk investments could give you a better return, and then the lower-risk investments, while they might be somewhat safer, that you won't net quite as much? Are they working on the same set of rules?
They're working on the same set of rules, yes. Obviously, if an opportunity looks too good to be true, it probably is for some reason that you're not aware of. But I think you do have to remember, too, that the pricing can get out of whack. And I think that's probably part of the reason why emerging markets have corrected some over the last year, because markets probably got too highly priced relative to the amount of risk you have to take to invest in these things. And it's not that the whole thing will fall apart, but there are individual areas where you could have some issues, and you weren't anticipating that when you paid 22 times earnings for that investment.
So maybe it was what Tom was talking about earlier. You had too many people who were chasing performance.
Right, yeah. Right.
You know, it is interesting, too, when you look at where we finished 2013. If you look at that, you know, just to kind of look back, you were up almost 30% in the Dow, S&P up 32%. And here are these four markets today, like Japan's down 11% year to date. Amazing.
Well, Chris and Madeline, thank you both very much for joining me this afternoon.
It was great to be here.
Thank you, Mark.
Financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and Madeline Matlock, senior portfolio manager with Pioneer Investments.